Hello, gals and fellas. I'm Katie Gannaway, and you're tuned in to a special episode of Arts Underground. In 1959, a beacon of American music, Fame Studios, which is short for Florence, Alabama Music Enterprises, emerged above a city drugstore in Florence, Alabama. Then, in 1961, after achieving international success in the music industry, Fame moved to its current location on Avalon Avenue in Muscle Shoals, churning out chart toppers for 65 years and counting. In today's conversation, Rodney Hall, president of Fame Recording Studios and one son of Fame's founder, Rick Hall, first takes us back a bit further before Muscle Shoals built its reputation as a sacred music city. Of course, this was a big place for people to come in the 30s to get work with TVA, the Dam, and music was sort of an escape from their work, like a thing they do when they come home. So can you talk about that transition of going from, you know, being a working town to music being the focal point?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting you bring that up. It's TVA changes this area drastically. I was reading the other day when the TVA bill was passed, that the town, not Muscle Shoals, I forget which, but the local towns here in the Shoals, went from about 500 citizens to about 20,000 in like 3 months. It was crazy. It was just a gold rush. And, you know, it completely changed the area. They brought electricity to the area, jobs, tons of jobs. So TVA was a major game changer. And before TVA, Muscle Shoals, the city of Muscle Shoals itself, was a swamp. So before they dammed the river up, it would flood. So there was just a lot of swamp land. So there wasn't a lot over here. And that's kind of why my dad ended up here, because they had dammed it up, everything dried up, and the land was cheap. So he literally bought swamp land to build the studio on.
And what is Fame's relationship with TVA today?
You know, we have a pretty good relationship with them. We do some things with them from time to time, and they're always kind and use us in a lot of their literature and videos that they do. And, you know, without electricity, it'd be pretty hard to record. So it's very helpful.
So people who come here to learn the history of Fame, starting, what, 59? Is that correct? Here, but over the drugstore.
Right, exactly.
Right. What tends to fascinate you most about the people who come here who want to learn? Like, have you heard any interesting questions that stick out? Or,
you know, the most interesting thing is just that people come from all over the world. I mean, from every country in the world, come here just to see where the music was made, and just, it's amazing to see what my dad and his friends did, you know, 65 years ago, that's still being heard all over the world. And, you know, even the earliest recordings touched the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. Arthur Alexander, who had the first hit here, You Better Move On, was covered by the Rolling Stones on their first album, and the Beatles covered the B-side. So just to see the you know, that little drop in the water, and to see the way the waves go out from that, has just been, that's what's phenomenal to me, is just that how much this little town changed music all over the world.
At what point growing up did it hit you that you are in the midst of this area of music and magic and all that?
You know, pretty early, because I was born in the 60s.
You weren't born here in the studio, though.
No, I wasn't. But the day when I was born, my dad had been in the studio that week with Wilson Pickett, and then they were recording Mustang Sally and Land of a Thousand Dances and Funky Broadway that week. So it was a good week for me. And we're still hearing those songs all over the world. But, you know, I was probably, you know, I kind of knew what my dad did, even at like the age of three. I remember knowing what he did. And I came up here a lot and play in the ashtrays, and, you know, and because at that time all the musicians had ashtrays, they all smoked, and it was so the ashtrays spun, so it was fun to come up and play in that.
At what point did he put you to work?
Oh, well, he put us to work we own a cattle ranch. He put us to work out there first, so that's
Fame Ranch.
Yes, exactly. So he put us to work out there first, so we were mowing grass and bush hogging and sling blading and painting fences and painting barns and all that kind of stuff. And then I came here in high school and did some work, but really didn't start working full time here until after college. And at that point, started doing full time work here. I actually lived in Huntsville for 2 years right after I got my master's degree at Alabama. I lived over there and worked for a guy named John Cockerham, who had a government contracting company called JMCA. And he had an offshoot business called Computer Exchange, because he had hundreds of employees doing government work, and they all had computers. So he had all these used computers, and we would sell the computers. And then we started selling to NASA and Boeing and all the different government contractors over there. So I did that for a while and lived in Huntsville, and then came here and started doing this in about 1992, three, somewhere around there. Really, when it hit me hard was because my dad had been doing soul music when I was, you know, before I was born, and then when I was 2-3 years old. And, you know, soul music is not really that much, it's kind of adult music, it's not really made for kids. So, but my dad started doing, in 1970, he started doing this band called the Osmonds, who were out of Utah and were great singers, great players. And they were all, the youngest was Donnie Osmond, who was 12 at the time. And they were all, and I guess the oldest was probably 20 at that point. So these guys were closer to my age. I was 4. But I remember, like yesterday, them coming to town. And the first time they came, they were at our house playing football with us, and nobody thought anything about it because they weren't hit recording artists yet. And then they had one bad apple, and the next time they came back, they were superstars. And, you know, we would ride our bikes around the neighborhood, and girls would be chasing us by the time we got back. It was crazy, and we were scared. We were running.
Well, you were only, what, 4, you said?
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I wasn't even old enough to, I couldn't even ride my bike, so I just watched them. My brothers and the Osmonds riding around, and all these girls come chasing them. I'd run in the house and hide. So... But at that point, and when we started going to some of their shows, and there was, you know, 12,000 girls screaming at the top of their lungs and passing out, and it was just like, what is this? It was crazy. But that's kind of when I realized. And then also, you know, Mac Davis would come here and record in the Osmonds, and all of them, Tom Jones, and they would be, you know, we would see them, and then a couple months later, we'd be sitting there watching Johnny Carson, and they would be on the Johnny Carson show. So I kind of, you know, realized that my friend's dad's workmates weren't on Johnny Carson. So I realized it was something different. But, you know, I knew that it was big, and I knew they were having hit records, but I didn't realize it was going to be historic like it is until much later.
Thinking back to A Fallen Star, mm-hmm. That one was recorded by, what, Ferlin Husky? I'm blanking on... other artists.
Bobby Denton had the original recording, and he recorded it with a guy named James Joyner at the local bus station. Yeah. And James was a publisher who published songs, and just with any random guy around town that thought they could write songs. He published a song called 6 Days on the Road. I forget the artist's name, but later Sawyer Brown covered it. It's been a hit by several people. Mm-hmm. But James was one of the first guys to do anything really in the music business here. Along with a couple other guys that I'm drawing a blank on right now. But James was owned the bus station. And in the back of the bus station, they had a tape recorder. And they would record, and I think they had a hamburger stand. And so that's where everybody hung out, was the bus station. And then my dad had worked with James, and James had published some of his songs, and he had had cuts on Roy Orbison and George Jones and Brenda Lee through James. And at that point, he decided that he was going to start his own publishing company. So he went in partnership with a guy named Billy Sherrill and Tom Stafford. Billy went on to be one of the greatest record producers in Nashville, and produced all of George Jones records and David Allan Coe, Johnny Paycheck. He ran Sony Columbia Records and Epic Records, which later became Sony. So he was huge. But they joined up, and they were in business for a couple of years, and then they split up, and my dad took the name Fame, which started out Florence Alabama Music Enterprises, and he shortened it to Fame, They didn't know it was going to spell out fame when they named it Florence, Alabama Music Enterprise, and they realized, hey, this is...
kind of like a eureka moment.
Right.
Exactly. Now everything's an acronym, so it's kind of like... but they're bad acronyms. It's like, you know, the local hospital, North Alabama Medical Center, they call it NAMCE. It's like, that's not a good acronym.
It sounds like my grandmother's name or something. Right. It's like, is that Nancy? No,
right.
No.
It's NAMCE.
That's not my grandmother's name, but a grandmother's name, I guess.
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
So we talked a little bit about you growing up here in the studio a little bit and meeting plenty of famous people. Who would you say were your other influences teaching you the ropes of the music industry other than your father, Rick Hall?
Oh, wow. That's a great question, too. So there was guys here that was like my uncles. There was a guy named Mickey Buckins, who was my dad's assistant, who I spent a lot of time with and still see from time to time. Mickey Buckins was here. You know, there was a guy named Alan Shulman, was an engineer that passed away a couple years ago. And he taught me a whole lot about the music business and engineering and producing specifically. He was one of my dad's top engineers. A guy named Don Shrigley, who passed away recently, was also another engineer that taught me a lot and brought me along. But more than any, other than my dad, I would say more than any, it would be Walt Aldridge, who was a legendary songwriter and producer and engineer. And he was here for 20 years, and, you know, basically from the time I was 13 or 14 until I was working here full time. And he's just an amazing songwriter, amazing musician, amazing producer, all those things. And he really taught me a lot. And my brother Mark had a lot of influence on my musical direction. Mark's a little older than me, and he's a lot older than me, actually, mm-hmm. Especially if he's listening. But Mark wrote a song called I Like It, I Love It for Tim McGraw, which is a huge record for him. And now Pitbull's...
now I just want to sing it. I like it. I love it.
Pitbull just sampled it and is using it on his new album. And Mark was worked with us. He ran our office in Nashville and was very involved. So, yeah, I've had a bunch of guys that... and all of them, you know. I mean, the guys in the Swampers and the Fame Gang, Clayton Ivey and David Hood and Owen Hale. And there's just been just hundreds. I've been... very lucky to have some of the most amazing musicians, producers, and songwriters in the world to grow up around. So, you know, you take a little bit from all those guys, and it's hopefully I've learned something.
I got to go upstairs, and I saw a photo that had your father and the Swampers sitting around him, you know, older in age. And that kind of proves to me maybe that there's not so much hostility between the two anymore, or was not any more hostility.
You know, there was initially after they left, and there's a lot to that story that doesn't get a lot of attention. They were leaving, and he had been to L.A. and just negotiated this whole new deal where they were going to get a piece of the pie, so to speak, on the royalties. And when they got back, they had already decided they were leaving, and they never even let him tell him what the deal was. So they'd already made their decisions to leave, and they left. And it was bitter. It was very bitter for my dad. I don't know that they were those guys say that they, you know, they never had a problem. They never were bitter or mad. They just wanted to do their own thing, and I understand that. Especially after working with my dad, because he was not easy to work with. So I get it that they wanted to do their own thing. I many, many times have thought to myself, I would love to do my own thing. But, you know, after about 4 or 5 years, they started a organization called the Muscle Shoals Music Association, which was, a lot of that had to do with just wanting to heal the wounds of the bust up. And, you know, it wasn't, they left. And it wasn't just that those four guys left. They left and they took my dad's secretary. They took his writers. They took basically his whole staff. So it was pretty bitter. But after a few years, they got back together and started doing some things. He went over there and did some recording. They came over here and did some recording. And, you know, later, definitely later in life, they were buddies again. And it wasn't, I think they were all proud of each other that they'd all done their own thing and been very successful at it.
Everybody loves a happy ending.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Those guys, David Hood and Jimmy specifically, those two guys have been, I was very close to them and still am to David. You know, Jimmy passed away, unfortunately, a few years ago. But they're both just like my uncles, and love them to death, and miss Jimmy every day. And there's pictures of him, us right there. I always, even when my dad was mad at him, I was listening to their records and going, that's cool. And I was proud that it was coming from Muscle Shoals too, you know. It wasn't like it all had to come out of here. It was always exciting. Rod Stewart just had a big hit over there, or Bob Seger, or whoever it was. Because they were doing a little bit different stuff than what he was doing over here at that point. So I told him, I said, you know, if they hadn't never left, this would have just been a one-horse town. It would have been one studio, but with two studios, multiple, you know, it proliferated. There were 11 studios at one time, and there's at least that many now, if not more, right here in the middle of what used to be a cotton field. It's not so much a cotton field anymore, but.
I mean, there's a McDonald's down the street, so.
Well, that's been there for a long time. Trust me, I've eaten many a French fry from the McDonald's.
How many would you say?
I don't know.
I would have too.
That was my favorite thing after school, was just to walk over to McDonald's and get some fries.
So you are an incredibly awesome, joyous, wonderful person in the 5 minutes I've known you. how do you stay from getting jaded with all of this surrounding you and being the president of Fame Recording Studios?
You know, it is hard not to get jaded, especially where the music business is nowadays. It's gotten, you know, over the last 25 years, it's just turned into a different animal. You know, the music business used to be controlled by the majors, and that wasn't a good thing. But it wasn't completely a bad thing either, because now what you have is you have no gatekeepers. So anybody on the planet that wants to make an album can literally do it for a few hundred dollars with a phone and a, you know, and a credit card. So there's more music released every day now than used to be released in an entire year. So it's just, how do you get through all that music? So there's just a mountain of music out there. Some good, some great, some terrible. Most terrible, honestly. It is. I mean, you know, there's a small amount that's great, and makes it harder to find because of all the other stuff. And it's just the whole streaming and downloading. There's definitely positives to it, but it's also made it harder because the money. You know, you used to could sell an album and make money. Now it's people pick their favorite song to listen to, and then that's the one that makes the money. So songwriters have a harder time, and because of that, artists build what we call camps. So they've got their guys that they write with. So we used to, back in the day, our writers could write a song, we could go to Nashville and play it for a record producer or a manager or an artist and get it cut. Now, if you're not in the clique, you don't get on the record. So it's just, it makes it a lot harder to be like an independent songwriter and make a living. But, you know, it is hard. You get hit up by a lot of people wanting to play you music, and it's frustrating on multiple levels. One, because, you know, most of the time it's not good. And the other reason is, even if it is good, I'm not sure that I can help them. You push through and do it. But do what you can, but it's just it's harder now than ever to break through, especially a new artist. And the sad thing is, with the new music and a new artist, is that back in the day, record labels would go, hey, you sound great, that's awesome, we're going to sign you and we're going to invest money in you. Now, it's, hey, you sound great, what's your social media numbers look like? And if you don't have social media numbers, I don't care how good you are. And I have this conversation all the time.
How can I sell your image?
Exactly. Can you build your image up to a point where we don't have to work as hard? And I have this conversation with artists constantly that, you know, you got to have that social media stuff. And I hate it that that's the case, because I would love to just go, your music's great, I want to help you. But it's just, that's just not possible anymore. at this moment in time. It may change. I don't know. I kind of doubt it, though.
Local music versus the big name artists who come through here. Like, what percentage would you say you work with local musicians versus, like, Alicia Keys or something like that?
You know, local musicians, like studio musicians, almost everything that we do. We hire, you know, local guys or Nashville guys or Huntsville guys. Or
For like know, sessions.
For sessions. But like people that come in and rent the studio from us, it's probably 10% local and probably 70% not local but not big. And then another, you know, whatever that leaves, big artist or about to be big artist or major label artists like the Warren Treaty or
Anderson. I love them so much.
Or, you know, Mike Ferris, that range of people. Not superstars, but they're on their way.
How do you feel about that percentage, that pie chart?
I think it's pretty fair. It's pretty fair. You know, I mean, it is what it is. People either want to record here or a lot of people think they can't afford to record here, but it's really not that, not, I mean, as a matter of fact, we're much cheaper than Nashville, New York, and LA, significantly. So it's not out of reach. And, you know, we work with people and there's ways to do it. You know, you can do part of it somewhere else and do part of it here. And there's also, you know, people, artists don't understand a lot of times you don't come in the studio to rehearse. You need to be prepared and rehearsed. You can do that in your den. And when you get here, you're not wasting time because you're paying by the hour or by the day. And so if you're prepared, you're going to have a lot better project. But, you know, I think that's, we love doing international stuff. We do a lot of artists from Europe and Spain and all over. That's always fun just to get their perspective on it all and why they're here and that kind of stuff. Then it's always great to do an Alicia Keys or a Steven Tyler or a Greg Allman or, you know,
Jack White, yep.
Jack White or Demi Lovato. Those are always fun. 95% of the time it's fun.
Well, it seems like it started as, you know, recording local, musically talented people.
Well, it started as songwriters, as publishers. My dad was a songwriter, and he had buddies that were songwriters, and they were all in bands and just playing local gigs. He had a radio show in Hamilton, Alabama on WERH.
Where is Hamilton?
It is between here and Tuscaloosa. They had a little radio station, and he had a weekly gig on there. And it was, you know, it went out back in the day. Radio stations, AM radio stations, reached fairly far. So I think it was a 50-watt station or something. I think it's like a light bulb. But he had that show, and they, you know, they just started doing it, and started having a little bit of success. And you know, they saw James Joyner and Bobby Denton have Fallen Star, and they're like, well, if they can do it, we can do it. And just everything just kind of propelled. And they also, my dad was also a big fan of Sam Phillips, who was from Florence and then moved to Memphis. And so Sam really, really intrigued him, and he thought that, you know, that thought a lot of Sam, and they became friends, and Sam gave him a lot of advice. And that really, you know, I think if not for Sam Phillips, there probably wouldn't have been a Muscle Shoals Music, even though he wasn't really directly involved in it, but he definitely influenced a lot of people.
I read there was something called the Mojo Triangle. Is that right?
Well, there's several names to that. There's the some people call it the Americana Music Triangle. I like to call it the Barbecue Triangle.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, that's Muscle Shoals, Memphis, and Nashville. And then, you know, there's other cities that come in too, Tupelo. And even New Orleans, and but yeah, that's a thing, and you know, a lot of that's based around the Natchez Trace, which runs from New Orleans to Nashville, and that's how people travel back in the day. That and the river, so people talk about there's something in the water,
the Singing River. Yep.
Yeah.
Read all about it.
Yeah, the we're skeptical about the Singing River somewhat, but you know, there's something to it. There's definitely something to it, and I think what there is to it is that people traveled by water back in the day and by the Natchez Trace, and you know, and people congregated around water. The Indians before, I mean, they all lived around water because that was, you had to have it, and there wasn't running water in the teepee. So they had to have, they had to be close to some water, you know. And then in the, you know, later in time, people traveled by boat. So I think that that's a lot of the water situation. And then, you know, if you look at, you look at some of the major music towns in the country that are on the water, Chicago, Memphis, Muscle Shoals, Nashville, they're all on some body of water.
What have you been listening to in your car lately? What do you like to roll the window down, do the dolphin hand out of the window?
Silence.
I did not expect that, but okay.
That's what's become, after, you know, I used to, when I was a kid, I would go home and my dad would raise Cain with us about playing music loud in our bedrooms or whatever.
Kind of cleansing your mind or something.
Right, and I just remember thinking, what's wrong with you? You're in the music business. But now I understand, after I've heard music every day, and it's work, it's your work, and you hear it every day, and it's like, you know, sometimes you just need silence. But with that said, I really, there's several artists out there that I like a lot. I love the Warren Treaty. They're amazing. Mike Ferris is amazing. Tyler Childers, I'm a big fan of his. Loving what he's doing right now. Of course, Bruno Mars and Alicia Keys and U2, and but mostly soulful stuff. John Batiste. I love John Batiste.
I love John Batiste. Yeah,
he's
yes.
Amazing. He's amazing. We thought we had him for a second for this show, and it just couldn't work out. We almost also had, we thought we had Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead, and that didn't happen either. But we're still working on a few other maybe surprise acts that could show up, and you never know who's going to be there. But yeah, that's kind of what I'm listening, other than what we do. I mean, that's, you know, when I'm working on an album, I'm listening to what that is all the time, because it's a progression over 6 or 8 weeks. You cut it, you start doing vocals, you do overdubs, and you start tweaking it and mixing it. So it's, you're constantly listening to it and critiquing it. So that's, you know, that's the majority of what I listen to. But when I'm listening for pleasure, that other stuff's my go-tos.
So for pleasure, you can turn it off like a faucet.
Yeah, but then it becomes just kind of background music.
Right.
You know, like listening around the house or whatever. Yeah, I don't want to critique their stuff. Either I like it or I don't. That's kind of the way that goes.
I saw you had a Prince t-shirt on in that little film that we watched earlier before the tour. Are you a big Prince fan?
I'm a huge Prince fan.
So am I.
Huge Prince fan. I grew up. I remember the first time I ever heard of Prince. I was in the fifth grade, and this friend of mine came in and had a Prince, the first Prince album. Is like, this is going to be the next big thing. And I'm like, right, whatever. he looks like a freak to me. And then next thing I know, I'm listening to it and just loving it. And I saw him 4 or 5 times. Saw the Purple Rain tour in 1985, January 17th, 1985.
Specifically,
yeah. It snowed 11 inches that night, and my mom didn't want me to go to the show, and I'm like, it's 60 degrees, it's not going to snow. We left Birmingham. By the time we got to Coleman, it was 3 or 4 inches of snow. So mama was right, but I was going to go anyway, and it was amazing. But I saw him 4 or 5 other times. That's one. There's several people that I like go, oh God, if he hadn't passed away.
I was going to ask, what's your white whale?
You know, it's like, well, there's Dwayne Allman, who worked with my dad, who I would have definitely gotten to work with. Otis Redding, who worked with my dad, I definitely would have gotten to work with him. Prince was there was really no connection other than I know that he was a fan because I've met Susan Rogers, who engineered a lot of his records, and she told me he was a fan. Yeah, at one time, Michael Jackson, but he probably fell off the list with his, as he got older and turned
into, no need to say more. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. But what an incredible talent musically, just phenomenal. He and Prince both during that, the 80s were just on fire. It was just amazing.
I wonder, whenever you are in the studio listening to people do their thing, at what point can you tell if it's going to be a good song or a bad song? And what do you do at that point?
You know, pretty immediately, you know, you have an idea whether this is going to be good. When you hear the singer sing it, and you hear the groove, if it's the groove is good and it's right, and you know, some will sneak up on you and you don't realize it till later, and some will sneak up on you the other way and like you think they're going to be good and then they're not. It happens all different ways, and every, you know, every, people talk about you know, what are sessions like. Well, they're all different. Everyone's different. You know, one maybe have a band come in that's all their guys, their own engineers. One may come in and they use all of our guys, or maybe a mixture of the two, or maybe somebody coming in, I'm just going to do vocals here. So every session is really different, and that keeps it interesting.
But the sound stays fresh, and that's sort of, I've watched an interview with you where you said it was sort of a slow evolution. I mean, you can't perfectly capture what it was like in the 60s and 70s, but how do you keep that spirit alive in the studios here?
You know, we still use a lot of the same techniques that we did back then, even though we're now, you know, we're not a tape based. We still use tape from time to time, but mostly it's digital. It's Pro Tools. You know, we still use a lot of the same techniques, the same micing techniques, the same. We still, you know, sit up in a room with five or six guys and girls and singers, and you know, all play off each other and work together. We haven't let it become computerized, so to speak, from that aspect. You know, from the recording as a tape machine, the computer is the tape machine now. But as far as the music being made, it's not generated by a computer or a synthesizer, you know, although we use synthesizers, but we don't do a lot of MIDI and, you know, programming. We don't do much programming at all. So, you know, I think that's our niche, is that we're, you know, it's very human oriented.
In all your time working here at Fame, what is your favorite aspect of this job, of being here? Like, what role do you most take pride in or passion in?
Wow, that's hard. I don't know. Although I guess the one that I enjoy the most is finding a young talent, whether it be a songwriter or a musician, and giving them an opportunity, proving that I was right.
Who are you thinking about? I feel like maybe there's somebody.
There's a lot of James LeBlanc, who is one of our songwriters for years, was a guy. Jason Isbell was another one. Gary Nichols from Steel Drivers was another. You know, and then there's, you know, then there's just like musicians like Jimbo Hart from the 400 Unit. And guys like that, just, and Jimmy Nutt, you know, who runs the Nutt House Studio now, was started here, and I kind of brought him into town with James LeBlanc's help. And so then there's Dylan LeBlanc, who's James' son, who I babysat when he was 10 years old and learned how to play Sweet Home Alabama sitting in the lobby out here. So yeah, it's a family thing. It's become a real family thing, and not just Hall family, but it's the Fame family. It's you know, everybody that's ever come through here and worked any significant amount of time as part of our family, which makes these shows like our 65th anniversary show that we're doing at the O'Ryan hard to do, because I want to include everybody, and it's like there's only so much time. So, and then like someone's like, I want to play all the songs. Well, yeah, but we got a lot of, but your brother wants to play too. So it makes it hard. You got 65 years, and it's just, honestly, it's the most daunting thing about this situation is just the massive amount of music that's been created here. It's hard for anybody to know all of it. I know more than I would say most anybody, because I've studied what happened before me, and then I know what's happened since I've been here. I say all that to say, it's just a mountain of music, and I think it would take, I did some like just guesstimates one time, and I can't remember what it was, but it was like 10 or 15 years it would take you to listen to all of it back to back to back, just 24 hours a day.
The 65th anniversary show is happening at the Orion in Huntsville. Can you describe your partnership, like how that was forged and why y'all chose the amphitheater to do it there?
Absolutely. You know, we have been, since before the amphitheater was built, we have been working with Max Grier at RCP in Mid-City, and we've been helping them with the camp and with different things. And then when the Orion was announced, we immediately were on board with that because North Alabama needs a world-class venue. It just did, you know, and Huntsville is a great place. It's close to us. It's, you know, an hour away. And so we started working with those guys and doing things, and met Ryan Murphy, who's amazing, and his staff is amazing. As I gotta tell you, it's been a dream working with those guys on this event. It just developed. We started selling merch over there during shows. They let us do that, and then we've done some after parties. We did Turnpike Troubadours after party, which we did Turnpike's last album. And it just evolved from that. And we were just talking to Ryan one day, and I was just telling him it was our 65th anniversary, and he said, we should do a show. And, you know, I'm like, serious? And now I'm going, dang, man, was I serious? Because it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work, but it's fun and it's fulfilling. And that night will be amazing. And it's going to be, I mean, the lineup is just phenomenal. You know, it's Robert Cray, Betty LaVette, Robert Randolph, Maggie Rose, Mike Ferris, John Paul White, Dylan LeBlanc, Scott Sherrard from Little Feet, Peter Levine from Greg Allman's band. He was Greg's second keyboard player. So to be Greg Allman's second keyboard player, you got to be something else. We got a whole slew of people, and we're going to have some surprise guests. Spooner Olam will be there. All the Muscle Shoals guys, the legendary guys, are going to be there from the different rhythm sections, the Fame Gang, the Muscle Shoals, the rhythm section. So it's going to be an amazing night, and, you know, we'll be honoring a lot of people that deserve to be honored over that have made amazing music over the years. We just started partnering with those guys and have loved it. And, you know, North Alabama is a special place, and we're excited about the growth in the Shoals area as well as in Huntsville. It's an exciting time, and we're proud to be working with the Orion. Matt Mandel's been great at the Huntsville Music Office, and, you know, it's just been a good partnership. And we were looking for a world-class facility to do this. And this is not the last, you know, kind of people in the shows. Some people in the shows are a little concerned that we're doing it in Huntsville, but what they don't remember is we did a free show over here 2 years ago that was free to the public for 8,000 people. And yeah, we did that. We're going to be doing more shows. We're planning one right now for 2025 in London. So we're going to take this thing and travel all over the world, preaching the gospel of North Alabama. So I think that's a good thing in the grand scheme of it all.
To kind of close out, what is the legacy that you want to leave behind you, Rodney Hall?
That I didn't put it out of business.
That's a really good one. Yeah.
Gotta keep the ball in the air. That's my objective here. You know, just that I continue the legacy. That these guys, all these guys, not just my dad, but the Swampers and the Fame Gang and the songwriters and the, you know, the musicians and the bands, there's just all these people. There's just hundreds and hundreds of people that have been involved in this whole movement, and just want to make them proud more than anything. Is just to keep their legacy alive as well as create new legacies through, you know, young artists and up and coming artists. And you know, so that's kind of my goal.
Is there anything else that you'd like to throw out there?
You know, we're growing, as a matter of fact. I mean, we're in a situation, we're doing better. We've diversified over the years. We've always diversified. That's why we're still here. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad was very much into, if this isn't working, we need to do something else. So when the recording studio piece kind of started, when home studios started coming in back in the 80s, he diversified into publishing. He 120 diversified into to record label. And so when you got all these things going, you know, one may be up, but the other will be down, but they all kind of bring everything. And now we've diversified into tourism, into merchandise. And, you know, we're about to open, and this will be the first time anybody's heard this, but we're opening what's called an Atmos room, a Dolby Atmos room in Florence. So we're going back to Florence for the first time in 60 years. What Dolby Atmos is, it's the new surround sound that everything is going to. So your phone has it built into it. All the new headphones will have it built into it. So it is a standard that all the major record labels are requiring you to turn in now. So everything's got to have a Dolby Atmos mix. So that's something we're doing. We're looking at some situations in Huntsville, honestly, and we have been for several years. If it wasn't for COVID, some of those would have already happened. But COVID set us way back. Yeah, we're growing, and just, we want to take it globally and, you know, do some fun, exciting things with music and entertainment in general.
Is there any lesson that you learned in your years here that you'd like to pass on to other people who want to break into the music industry, whether they are artists or producers or anything else like that?
You know, just a couple things I would say. One is do a little bit of everything. If you're a musician, learn how to engineer, learn how to record yourself, learn how to write songs, learn how to do all of it. And if you find that one piece of that you are better than other things, focus on that and become great at it. But learn about all of it, because it's all important. And learn the business. Practice makes perfect. It's an old saying, but it holds true.